I was late getting here tonight. I traded in my quartz watch for a sundial, and it got dark. You know, as far as I'm concerned, as a speaker, that's great stuff. I mean, go by the seasons. Start in the dry season and hope you end up wet, or it's the other way around. I've also appreciated several of you who responded in a thunderous way to tell me that you came this week because I was here. Both of you. Except one person said, I thought you were last week. That's why I came this week. Well, communication breaks down. One of my favorite stories, you know, I'm just getting into this thing, is of a woman that was taking a trip around the world. And she got to London, and she called back home. In the course of the conversation, she said to her husband, how's the dog? And he said, well, the dog's dead. She said, the dog's dead? He said, yeah, the dog's dead. She said, you beast. You know how much I love that dog. And you just blurt it out and almost destroy me with it. I said, what should I have said? Well, she said, you could have told me that the dog was up on the roof. And then when I called you from Paris, you could have told me the dog fell off the roof and was hurt. And then when I got to Rome, you could have told me that the dog was in very serious condition. And then when I called from Moscow, you could have told me the dog died. She said, how's mother? I said, well, she's up on the roof. You've had a long day today, and I realize that many of you are many of you are tired. In fact, some of you came in your night clothes. I don't mind you sleeping. It's just when you stretch out over three people next to you, we all have problems. Well, we'll give it a go. And if sometime towards morning the sun comes up, my sundial will tell me to stop. Some time ago, when I was directing the Christian Medical Society, A missionary physician returned home from the field. He was a man who had turned his back on a promising career in surgery in order to minister to people in the Far East. He came back for his furlough. He was being interviewed by a group of reporters. And one of the reporters asked this man why he left his career in the United States to go to a country where medicine was still very primitive. And this surgeon said, well, God sort of gave us a love for those people. And they had deep needs, and we felt that we could meet them. The reporter wasn't too happy with the answer, and so he pushed it a bit further. He said, yeah, I know that, but aren't there any other reasons that you went? And the missionary thought and said, well, there are rewards in what we do, but I think it's honest to say that we went because we loved the people. When the interview was over, the reporter was folding up his notebook, and he turned to a photographer that was with him. He said, you know, it's tough to figure a guy like that out. Everybody has an angle, and I don't know what his is. Somehow, that evaluation by a hard-bitten reporter seems almost to be a summary of our time. Everybody has an angle. In fact, we sometimes teach that to our children. We say, whatever else you do, look out for number one. Because if you don't, nobody else will. Or we say with a kind of half-smile, better do others before they do you. And we think that that's practical advice. After all, this is a rough, tough, competitive old world we live in. And you better not put anything into the machine unless you're sure you're going to get something out. Perhaps because we are so used to working the angles, we tend to shrug off the incessant demands of the New Testament that if we know Jesus Christ, we are to be people who love. Oh, we're willing to confess other sins. We're willing to confess that there are times we doubt and don't believe. But very few of us confess that we are unloving people. After all, we're as loving as the next guy. We give money to the church. In fact, sometimes we give sizable gifts. What is more, we contribute to other charities in our community. And we have friends, and we're kind to them. And now and then we take a bowl of soup to a sick neighbor. That's about as much love as you can muster in a society like ours. And don't misunderstand me. I don't take that lightly. I'm sure that men and women give to their church out of an expression of love for Jesus Christ and a concern for people in the community. And it may be that your network of friends depends heavily upon you, and as you live with them, you minister to them. And I could not, as a servant of Jesus Christ, despise a bowl of hot soup. I serve a master who honored a cup of cold water. But sometimes, even when we are involved in what look like acts of love, we can be working the angles. We can give our goods to feed the poor because there's a good tax advantage in it. Some wag has said the gift without the deduction is worthless. Some time ago, a group of people waiting for a bus in New York City stood in front of a pet store. It was a cold, wintry day, and in the window of that the pet store were a group of puppies all huddled up together. And a woman, seeing that, spoke to anybody who was listening, and she said, isn't that a wonderful picture of brotherly love? Look at how those puppies are keeping each other warm. And a cynical New Yorker said, lady, they're not keeping each other warm. They're keeping themselves warm. And sometimes what we call love is closer to puppy love. We give because we get. We end up working the angles. And yet, in the light of that, the New Testament tells us again and again that God is calling us to be folks who don't work the angles, who live for the benefit of others, live a life of love. Jesus, on the night before he was betrayed, gathered his men around him and said, by this shall all men know that you are my disciples, because you love one another. And in a church where there is tension and strife, that church has lost its right to represent Jesus Christ in the world. It may be an Episcopalian church or Roman Catholic or Baptist or Presbyterian, but it is not Christ's church. The thing that marks out God's people in this world is that they have a contagious love for each other. John, in his correspondence, put it even more bluntly. He said, he that does not love does not know God, for God is love. And Paul, in 1 Corinthians 13, adds his voice to the voices of the New Testament. In the first stanza of this great hymn to love, Paul is saying that all of our gifts, as impressive as they may seem, all of our service, as devoted as it may look, all of our sacrifices, as hard as they may appear, if they are done apart from love, accomplish nothing, make us nothing, and gain us nothing when we stand before God. So the question that we must answer is, what is this thing called love? This agape love, the dominant love of the New Testament, what is it? an abstract level, it's the love that seeks the other person's highest good, that puts another person's interests before its own. It's the kind of love that just doesn't work the angles. But in 1 Corinthians 13, verses 4 through 7, Paul defines that kind of love by describing it. In 15 strokes, he shows us a portrait of love in action. He tells us, for example, that this love of which he writes, that is to characterize us as the people of God, is very patient. It's patient because if you're ever going to love, you've got to love people. And people have all kinds of neuroses and hang-ups and frustrations, and they disappoint you and they sin. But if you can't handle that, you can't be patient with people, then you'll discover that you end up manipulating, giving love when you get what you want, working the angle, but not giving love because you seek what is best for the other person. This love is also kind. It says the bracing word to those who are weary and hurting. It does the gracious act for those who are caught on the barbed wire of life. One of the things that ought to characterize us as God's people is a constant flow of those little unremembered, unnamed, unheralded acts of kindness and love. And then, having given us that introduction, Paul proceeds to show us what love does not do. The first three things he selects deal with the fact that there are differences in the world, differences among people. All of us have different gifts, different positions, different opportunities, different accomplishments. So love does not envy. Love does not look at what God has done in someone else's life, in another person's talent, and get upset by that. It simply recognizes that God, in his sovereignty and goodness, has given me what I need and given you what you need. And it doesn't envy. On the other hand, it doesn't boast. When love has strengths and others have weaknesses, love does not display its gold medals in the store window for everybody to see. It just recognizes that with the gift there goes responsibility. And love is not puffed up. It does not have exalted opinions of itself. It does not look down with a kind of scornful eye at other people. It just recognizes that in the grace of God, it is what it is and settles for that. But then in verse 5, Paul goes on to describe love in social situations. In the King James Version, it says, love does not behave itself unseemly. The New International Version says that love is not rude. Putting it positively, love has good manners. I realize that a discussion of manners in connection with love may seem as out of place as a sweatshirt at a formal dinner. Manners just don't seem to be that spiritual or that important. We tend to look at manners as a nice addition, but really unnecessary. Perhaps the reason for that is that we sometimes confuse manners and etiquette. The word etiquette comes from the French word, which means card. And back in the glorious days of the French royalty, if a man or woman had an audience with the king, they were given a card that told them how to enter, when to speak, how to bow, when to leave. As a result, etiquette comes to stand for those rules, many of them very complicated, that govern the way that we meet and greet and eat. In the United States, those rules sometimes seem to us to be stuffy and unnecessary. But Paul's talking about manners. And manners go beyond etiquette. Manners deal with the manner in which we relate to other people. And all of us do that. Therefore, all of us have manners. Some good, some bad, many of them in between. We just have a way of getting along or not getting along. And what Paul is saying is that love makes us gracious. Love is never rude. It never puts people down. It makes people feel at home in our company. If you're a loving person, you'll be a gentleman or a gentlewoman. I grew up in the heart of New York City, in a section of New York called Harlem, part of Harlem called Mousetown, an area that Reader's Digest said was the toughest section in the United States. The social workers called it a depressed area. The tour guides that brought people through our neighborhood called it a ghetto. People in the city called it a slum. We called it the neighborhood. Our streets were littered with garbage and glass. The halls of our apartment houses smelled of urine. And in Mousetown, there wasn't a large emphasis on manners or etiquette. You said somebody was good with a knife. You weren't talking about the way he cut his meat at the table. When I was 16, I went to college. When I got to college, I discovered a world I never knew existed. I discovered there were all kinds of rules that you followed in social situations. I discovered you introduced a man to a woman, a young person to an older person. I discovered there was a way to put your knife and fork across the plate, and it was a way to pass food to other people. Man, after I was away at college for one semester, I was educated beyond my intelligence. I remember coming home that first Christmas vacation. And there was a woman in our church, a rather wealthy woman, who decided that she would take a number of us to one of the more fashionable restaurants in New York City. I was delighted to go. And then she spoiled it all by telling me that she was inviting my father to come. And I knew my dad didn't know the rules. And I thought the evening was going to be a royal mess. The truth is, it was a lot worse than I thought it would be. We got to this formal dining room and got past the maitre d'. There were two waiters there dressed in tuxedos. And my father broke ranks and went over to talk to one of the waiters. He asked him how business was. He asked him if he made enough tips to make it worth his while to serve all of these swanky people. Then we sat down and instead of giving his order to the host, he just gave it directly to the waiter. After all, they just made a deep friendship, and he didn't want to go through the channels. And then in the meal itself, since my dad believed the shortest distance between two points was a straight line, you asked for food, he passed it to you. Didn't bother with Mr. in between. I remember one time he had a fork that he had used, didn't know what to do with it, so he put it down on the tablecloth. And I sat there feeling my face get red. And it's tough to be embarrassed about your dad. At any rate, after the disaster was over, a few days later, I met the lady who had been our hostess for dinner. And she said, "You know, I'm delighted your father was able to come. He's such a gentleman. He's so thoughtful of others." At first, I thought she was mocking me. And then I realized that she meant it. That in all my dad did, he really was concerned about other people. He just didn't know the rules. Perhaps that was why, years later, when I was reading Henry Drummond, I noticed his comment when he said, you can take the most untutored man or woman and put them down in the midst of high society, and if they have a reservoir of love, they will not behave themselves unseemly. They simply cannot do it. Those folks that were with us at dinner looked beyond the rules and recognized that my father cared about people. Love is never rude. Love has good manners. It's interesting that in Greek, the word charis is sometimes translated grace. Other times it's translated charm. That means that if you understand grace and graciousness, you'll be a charming person. If you're really acting in love, you will never deliberately be rude. I tried to think about why sometimes in the busyness of life that happens. By the way, you've got to understand, this is no plea for crudeness. I think that manners and etiquette are very much a part of life. It's just that that love gives etiquette a soul. You know all the rules of etiquette, and you don't love, you end up being a snob. But if you want to make people feel comfortable around you, then you learn the rules, because those rules keep us from knocking together in the landslide of life. They just make people comfortable. If that's what they do, I want to learn them. But why is it that sometimes we are rude? I think one reason that we may be rude is that sometimes we concentrate on other virtues and do not infuse those virtues with love. I think we would do well if we could have an institute on basic manners for Christians. I think the folks who ought to attend are some of my friends who are very zealous to see people come to know Jesus Christ. I say it honestly, I admire their zeal. I admire their deep concern, but sometimes in their eagerness to bring people to the Savior, they grab people by the lapel and give them a kind of religion that never gets any deeper than the shirt pocket. Sometimes by their clumsy, almost rude way of doing it, they hurt the gospel of God's grace. There are folks who have honesty and are proud of that virtue, but they don't have sympathy. They have candor without kindness. My observations are that when you meet people who are proud of calling a spade, you often end up treating other people like dirt. Another reason that we are rude, sometimes it's because there are virtues that don't have love, but another reason is just flat out we're selfish. We want the best for ourselves. We're so interested in working the angles for us that, well, we just don't pay attention to other people. That's what happened at the church at Corinth. Remember in chapter 11, you get the insight as to what was going on in that first century church. When people worshiped back then, they worshiped on a Sunday evening. They did not sit in formal rows like this. Instead, they gathered around a supper table. It was the beginning of the potluck supper. Everybody brought what they could. The people who were wealthy usually brought a great deal. The people who were poor brought less. Some of the slaves brought nothing. For many of the slaves, it was probably the best meal that they had had all week. But after a while, the wealthy people who got there early and did not have the restrictions of time would gather, and they would share their food with one another, and the poor slaves showed up. They got nothing. And Paul says in 1 Corinthians 11, that was not just a breach of manners. That was a sin against love. That was a blasphemy against the body and blood of Jesus Christ, the communion that they shared at that common meal. And sometimes the tradition of that first century church is carried out by churches today. The service ends and we immediately go to find our friends and to get into a clique. And, we're in a small group and it's closed. Nothing wrong with a small group, provided that it's open. But whenever a small group closes and other people are not let in, that's a sin against love. And people can come to our church and feel that we are as cold as space, as distant as a star. We have been so interested in ourselves, we are rude. And we have not been loving. Sometimes we're rude because we're inconvenienced. Other people have offended us and we lash out at them. Dr. Richard Sumi was for many years the pastor of the Baraka Church in Houston, Texas. And at one time they had a nationally known Bible teacher come to the church for a week of lectures. One evening, before they went to the church for the service, Sumi and this teacher were out at a restaurant having dinner. And as the waitress was trying to serve the food, she spilled a glass of water on this visiting minister. It was upsetting, obviously, and he was drenched, and he had to go to the church, and he lashed out at her with fiery, harsh, bitter words. He told her what he thought of what she had done. The girl left almost in tears. After she left, Sumi leaned across the table and said, "Doc, when that girl comes back, I dare you to witness to her." He couldn't do it. That harsh, rude response was so out of keeping with the graciousness of Jesus Christ that a word of witness would have been a form of blasphemy. No, love is not rude. Love has good manners. Love always seeks to make other people comfortable around it. It seeks to reach out and make other people feel at home. A small girl was once said to have prayed, "Dear God, make all the bad people good. Make all the good people nice." Love does that. But then Paul goes on to say that love not only has good manners, but love has good motives. What he says is that love does not seek its own. That is, love, this agape love, exists for other people. Its learning is for the benefit of others. Its service is for the good of others. Its prayer is for the advancement of others. It doesn't work the angles. It exists for others. That's not true of our society generally. As Mr. Guernsey was saying this morning, we have a society that exists for me, my wife, my son John, his wife, us four, and no more. We're pretty self-centered. In fact, we're often very much like Charles Dickens' description of Dombey and Son. Remember it? He wrote Dombey and Son. These three words conveyed the one idea of Mr. Dombey's life. The earth was made for Dombey and Son to trade in. The sun and moon were made to give them light. Rivers and seas were made to float their ships. Rainbows gave them promise of fair weather. Winds blew for or against their enterprises. Stars and planets circled in their orbits to preserve inviolate a system of which they were the center. AD, after a date, had no concern with Anno Domini, but stood for Anno Dombey and Son. things haven't changed much over the last 100 years. In fact, recently a novelist was describing a woman in his novel. Her name was Edith. He said that Edith was an island, surrounded on the north by Edith, on the south by Edith, on the east by Edith, and on the west by Edith. Anywhere Edith looked, all she saw was Edith. Yet Paul says that love does not seek its own. When we come to know Jesus Christ, really come to know Him, the arrows of our life begin to turn outward, upward first to God, outward to others. And we seek what is best for them and not simply for ourselves. Folks in Corinth needed a dose of love. Remember in 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and 1 Corinthians chapter 10, they faced a problem in Corinth that was a theological problem, a social problem. You see, at the center of the city of Corinth, there was a temple to the goddess Aphrodite. She was the goddess of sensual love. In fact, there was one time in the history of the Greeks that there were between 5,000 and 7,000 temple prostitutes that existed to do her bidding. You can be sure with women like that doing the personal work that the sailors that flooded into Corinth made easy converts to that kind of religion. If you think of sexual debauchery, they had it wrapped up in the worship of Aphrodite. Well, the people in Corinth brought offerings to her. They brought animals. When the animal was offered, a really small part of it was placed on the altar. Another part of that animal was given to the priest as a kind of honorarium. The third part of the animal was given back to the worshiper so that the worshiper could have a feast in honor of the goddess. Now, there was no refrigeration. That meant that the meat had to be eaten right away. So when the priests wanted to turn their meat into money, they had a meat store right there at the temple. If you wanted to buy a roast or leg of lamb, that's where you went. And the worshiper, he had his third of the animal. And so he'd throw a feast. He had a home large enough, he'd have it there, or if not, he had a room close to the temple, and he invited his friends to come. And that meant if you had a pot roast in Corinth, the chances were that morning it was offered to the goddess Aphrodite. So the question was, you ate meat offered to an idol. Did that make you an idolater? And so in 1 Corinthians 8, Paul writes to say, look, you know your theology. You know that an idol is nothing, just a slab of stone sitting up on a shelf. You offer meat to an idol, it doesn't change the quality of the meat. You can feel free to eat it. But that wasn't the final thing you were to work on. If you knew that somebody seeing you eat that meat offered to an idol might somehow be tempted to eat the meat and, because of the psychological associations, be drawn back into the old life, then Paul says, you'd better not eat the meat. You know better, but the other person doesn't. In the last verse of chapter 8, Paul states the principle. Therefore, if what I eat causes my brother to fall into sin, I'll never eat meat again, so I won't cause him to fall. You see, love doesn't seek its own. In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 27, Paul takes up another case. He says, if an unbeliever invites you to a feast and you want to go, go. You don't have to pray about it. You don't have to go if you think you can give them the four spiritual laws. Just go and eat anything that's set before you. Don't ask dumb questions. Don't say, where did you get the meat? That's rude. It doesn't make any sense to climb a flagpole to make an enemy if you can stay on the ground and make a friend. Just enjoy the feast. On the other hand, if your host makes an issue of it, if he says, have some meat. We offered it to Aphrodite this morning, and she always satisfies the desires of the body. Paul says, in a case like that, because it's an issue with him, you better stick with the vegetables. Fill up at the salad bar. Or if the fellow sitting next to you is a Christian, and he says to you, you know where they got the meat? I saw them this morning. They got it at the idol's temple. Paul said, you might like the pot roast, but it would be better to pass it because for this person, it can be a spiritual issue. And again, in 1 Corinthians 10, he spells out the principle in verse 24. He says, when you're coming to decide issues like that, nobody should seek his own good. He should seek the good of others. That's what it means, that love does not seek its own. It seeks another person's highest good. See, love has good manners, and love has good motives. And Paul goes on in verse 5 to tell us that love also has good mood. He says that love is not easily provoked. It's interesting. In the original, the word easily is not there. I suspect it was put in by some short-tempered translator. Actually, other translations say that love is not irritable. And I suspect that when I say to you that love is not irritable, that there are some of you who get a bit irritated at that. Find yourself shifting in the seat saying, look, picky, picky, I mean, if you're going to get down to things like irritation and sort of make that a part of love, count me out. I mean, if you knew the turkeys I got to work with and listening to that gobbledygook all day, you'd know why I got irritated. You had a husband like mine doesn't even know how to squeeze a toothpaste tube correctly. You'd understand my irritation. If you had a wife that didn't know how to fill out a checkbook, and I had to do the whole arithmetic over every month. You don't understand my irritation. And certainly, if you knew that at least 1 week of every month, I mean, I have reason to be irritated. So does my wife. You'd understand that, you know, that I get irritated because of my circumstances, because of my personality. And if God doesn't understand that, count me out. I'm no plaster of Paris saint. Let's grant your argument. I think there's probably a lot of truth in it. I'm sure that there are some of us who find irritability besetting kind of sin because of our personalities. There are some of you who have the disposition of a sheepdog. I mean, nothing flusters you. It's not grace, it's just glands. It's the genes, the way you were born. But others have the disposition of a bulldog. You're wound up tighter than a banjo string. You don't ever lose your temper. It's always right out there where everybody can see it. Like a man who went to his friend to exhort him not to lose his temper, to control it. And the guy said, look, I control more temper in 5 minutes than you do in 5 years. No, let's admit it, that you have problems with irritability. Other people have problems with shoplifting or lust. But I suspect that when you say that is that irritability is for you a besetting sin, that's not really what you mean when you say it's a problem of your personality or your circumstances. What you really are saying when you say that is that people ought to overlook it. The strange thing is we feel that God and others ought to make allowance for that. And yet that's precisely what irritable people don't do for others. That's why irritability is usually the vice of the virtuous. It's the affliction of the perfections. You want things just so, and if people don't do it just so, you give them so what? You want everything to revolve around your little universe, and if it gets out of control, you become irritable. I'm convinced that for many people, irritability is a habit that we fall into. To a large degree, we can choose our moods. Because the interesting thing about irritability is we're usually irritable with the people who are closest and dearest to us. We're irritable with our spouses, not with our colleagues at work. Irritable with our children, but not the folks in the neighborhood. It's when we come home that we let the irritability fly. But we don't do it with the boss. No. He can't imagine that anything ruffles us. LaFontaine was a chaplain in the Prussian army. There was a sergeant major who was known for losing his temper with his men. And the man was a professing Christian. And so LaFontaine went to the man and told him what he had heard. And the man said, look, I can't help it. It's just the way I'm made. And so the chaplain said, if you stood before your king and the king did what your men did, would you lose your temper with him? The man said, no, of course I wouldn't. And LaFontaine says, you live your life before the King of Heaven. Be aware of his presence. A few days later, the sergeant major came back to the chaplain and said, chaplain, you're right. When you see me fall, I want you to remind me of the king. And I do that for you tonight. You live your life in the presence of the King of Glory, the King of Love. And you want to be aware of his presence and to be aware of the fact that often irritability is something you choose to express. But you wouldn't express it to the king. And you ought not do it before him. And when it happens, you ought to acknowledge it to God for what it is. Kind of nasty sin. Kind of thing that tarnishes relationship. And ask God for forgiveness and accept his grace. And go on. Let me just take one more. He says in verse 5 that love not only has good manners and good motives and good moods, but love has good memories. He says that love does not keep record of wrongs done against it. The King James Version says that love thinks no evil. That's really true, of course. Love would never plot evil against other people. But the word that's used here is a word that is used of a bookkeeper who marks something down in a book in order to keep record of it. It's a debt owed, and he expects to collect. But he's saying that love does not keep record of wrongs done against it. In a lifetime, all of us have opportunity to cherish hatred or extend forgiveness. A friend that we trusted betrayed us. A colleague cheats us in a business deal. A mother-in-law interferes with a marriage. A spouse in anger says hot words that burn into our souls. With the object of gossip, we didn't do anything, but the gossip is there, and it has soiled our reputation. The list is endless. When that happens, unforgiveness, like a choking weed, can seize our souls. Our sense of righteousness has been offended, and we feel that we want to get back, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a slight for a slight. Just want to get revenge. A while ago in Texas, in the Sunday supplement of the Dallas Morning News, they told the story of a wealthy Texas oilman. And they asked him what he was living for. And he responded, to get even. Someplace a few years before, somebody had crossed him and hurt him. It was the object of his life to pay that person back. You see, we can do that. We can write down in the ledger of our mind some wrong done against us, and we can bring it out again and again as a debt that is owed, that has to be paid to us. I remember having dinner with a couple. As the meal began, they told me of an offense done against them. The wife gave it to me in all detail, and anything she lacked, the husband filled in. They were telling the truth, and I suspect they were. They had been hurt. And then I discovered, to my amazement, that that had happened to them 10 years before. And for 10 years, to anyone that would listen, they would tell the story again and again. They had a ledger, and they had marked it down, and they wouldn't forget it. James Broderick, in his book, The Progress of the Jesuits, says this about Pope Paul IV. He never forgot slights done to him, which was his fundamental weakness. He might bury the hatchet for a time, but he gave the impression of always marking the spot. You and I select our memories. A child wants to remember a spelling word. He goes over it again and again. If an actor wants to remember his lines, he reviews them. If you want to remember names, you keep going over them. You can choose to select the memories of wrongs done against you until they destroy relationships and they end up destroying you. What can you do? If right now, as I am speaking, something has surfaced to your mind and you think of a wrong that's done against you that you keep chewing on and go back to like a dog that has buried a bone. Let me suggest three things. One thing you can do is turn that over to God. Let God handle it. Let Him be your debt collector. Oh, I know that's tough. Sir Walter Scott said that vengeance is the sweetest morsel to the mouth ever cooked in the pots of hell. Something enticing about going over a wrong. Something sour-sweet about it. But God said, vengeance is mine. I will repay, says the Lord. So deliberately turn that thing over to God. Let Him deal with it. Secondly, remember, if you're a Christian, how God has dealt with you. Whatever slimy things you have in your life, if you have really trusted Christ, you are forgiven. And when God forgives, God forgets. You may continue to remember it, but God has wiped it out. Remember those words in Hebrews chapter 8, verse 12? Where God says, I will be merciful toward their iniquities, and I will remember their sins no more. The psalmist picked it up in Psalm 103:12, when he said, as far as the east is from the west, so far does He remove our transgressions from us. I remember as a kid, when I first came across that verse, I knew enough science to know that if you take off to the west, ultimately you come around to the east, and I wondered if someplace out there you might bump into your sin again. Then I realized that true east and true west go out into infinity. And God is saying that when He forgives, our sins are as far from us as the furthest point of space is from any other point in space. God forgives. God forgets. You said to me, oh, yeah, but doesn't God remember something? Oh, yes, he does remember. The writer of Hebrews says in Hebrews 6:10, for God is not so unjust as to forget your work and the love which you showed for his sake in serving the saints. That's just the way God is. He forgets what we remember. He remembers what we tend to forget. You need to forget about your debtors and remember your creditors. You need to be a lot like God that way. The third thing you need to do is to recognize that if you are really a forgiven person, you can be a forgiving person. Frankly, I don't know how non-Christians handle all of this. But I do know that if you have come to really put your trust and confidence in Jesus Christ, then God forgives you, and you're forgiven fully, finally, freely, forever. God has forgiven you all of the things in your life, and you can forgive others. Several years ago, when I was in Dallas, I dealt with a couple in which the husband had been unfaithful to his wife. By the way, I asked for their permission to tell you the story. It was a deep wound to the wife. You can imagine. She felt betrayed. Her feeling about herself was hurt. It was a lack of trust. He was deeply sorry and had, as far as I could tell, repented, but his wife said to him in my presence, I can forgive, I guess, but I just can't forget. In fact, I'm not really sure I can forgive it. A few days later, this young woman was on the campus, and I asked her to come by to my office. And we sat for a few moments, and then I said to her, are you a Christian? One of those irritating questions. We both knew that she was. She said, yes. And I said, well, when you became a Christian, how bad were you? She said, what do you mean? I said, well, how bad were you? She said, well, you know, I was just like, you know, an ordinary kind of person. By the way, I find that ordinary sinners are the worst kind to deal with. I mean, give me a major league sinner anytime. Ordinary ones are tough. I said, well, let me press that a bit. I said, suppose we had a This Is Your Life program with you. We were going to put on the screen over in the chapel tonight not only all of the good things you did, but we were going to put in all the bad things, stuff you've covered up and would rather forget. If we did that and we showed it tonight, would you come? She said, no. I don't think I'd be there. Well, I said, suppose we could really do a job on you. Suppose we could do a kind of psychodrama. We were not only going to deal with the things you've done, but we could get inside your head. All those fantasies, all those things you thought about doing but just didn't dare do because of the conventions. I'm going to put that on the screen. How would we rate it? PG? R? X? She said, you'd rate it triple X. So I said, now, when you became a Christian, how much of that garbage did God forgive? She said, all of it. I said, all of it? She said, yeah, he forgave all of it. And I said, tell me again why you say you just can't forgive your husband what he did. She sat there for a moment or two and then said to me, sounds kind of stupid, doesn't it? And it does. Oh, she had to work through the emotion of it, but today they have a very happy marriage. But you see, if you know the forgiveness of God, if you are really a forgiven person and you have really entered into that, then you can be a forgiving person and wipe out the record of wrongs done against you. Tennyson said of Archbishop Cranmer these lovely words that I want to be true of me. He said, to do him a wrong was to beget a kindness from him, for his heart was so rich of such fine mold that if you sowed therein the seeds of hate, it blossomed love. Maybe there's something you need to deal with. Some friend to whom you owe a letter, and there's been something between you for a long time. Perhaps there's a phone call you can make. Perhaps when you get home, you can determine that you're going to get that thing settled. Perhaps there's some incident that keeps coming out of the cemetery of your soul that you need to bury and put dirt over it and put up a gravestone and put nothing on the stone and forget it. For God's sake, for your own sake, for love's sake, do it. Love has good manners. Love has pure motives. Love has good mood. And love has poor memory. It doesn't work the angles. A couple of years ago in Decision Magazine, a 7-year-old boy scrawled a note to Billy Graham. It said, "Dear Billy Graham, I love God and I love Jesus and I try to obey them. Your friend, Johnny." Then he wrote, "P.S. I love people too." That's the mark of really knowing Jesus Christ. Let's pray. Father, I realize that it's tough to pray. There are folks here tonight who perhaps have some incident in their lives that has gnawed away at their soul that they need to deal with. I'd ask that they may have the courage and the love to do that. I suspect, Lord, in this crowd there are some folks who, when we talk about the forgiveness of sins, hear it only as theological jargon, but do not know of a certainty that if they stood before you tonight, they could do so knowing with absolute certainty that you don't hold their sin against them anymore. We pray for those folks that before they leave, they shall come to that trust in Jesus Christ, in which through the death that he died upon the cross, he extends to them forgiveness of sins. But Lord, we commit this group of friends to you for whatever needs they have, and pray that we shall continue to be people who love because of the work of your Spirit in our lives. For Jesus' sake and for our own sake and for the sake of those who have to live with us, we ask it.